Vancouver, British Columbia.
It's the Economic Science Edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, we take a skeptical look at whether economics is science or not. Let's begin episode 225.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sort, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We have traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker. This is Don, your political science philosopher. And this week we have a special host emeritus, Daniel Gipps, in the studio. Say hello, Daniel.
Hello. If you're a longtime listener, you might remember me as Daniel, economics student at UBC. But I've since gone on to better things. And now I'm Daniel, computer science student at UBC.
Ooh. So you found that there is no money to be made in economics?
Pretty much.
So this week I'd like to start off with one of my classic rants about the Quebec Charter. The Quebec Charter is intended to support, ostensibly, a division between religion and the state. They originally floated this idea as a secular charter during the election. And at the time, you know, some of us in the skeptical atheist kind of community thought, hey, this should be a good idea, could be a good idea, by, again, creating a separation of church and state, which really doesn't exist here in Canada. Unfortunately, it seems to be really just largely an election ploy of the Quebec government. The idea is that they want people to assimilate to Quebec's culture. And in doing so, they've actually kind of, well, one, they've turned out to be slightly racist. And two, they've actually sort of hurt the cause of a secular state by being so overtly disingenuous with it. For example, there's five things that, you know, the charter will do. So it will bar public sector employees, including people who are like teachers and judges and even helping out at municipal sports arenas for soccer and such, from wearing things like the hijab, the kippah, large religious symbols. Anything that's sort of ostensibly religious in nature, they will be denied to wear. There will be a certain five-year opt-out for certain organizations, but not things like daycare or elementary school teacher. Anything that's to receive public funding would face the same sort of restrictions. And the Quebec would amend its human rights legislation, Charter of Human Rights and Freedom, to specifically limit the religious claims someone could make for freedom. Oddly enough, things that it won't do is it won't remove religious symbols and elements considered emblematic of Quebec cultural heritage. So this includes things like the crucifix that's on the Quebec legislature and at the top of Mount Royal, Montreal. It doesn't ban public sector employees from wearing small religious symbols like a ring with the Star of David or earrings. It would not eliminate subsidies for religious private schools, which strikes me as a huge, huge one to overlook. It would not ban opening prayer in municipal council meetings, and it doesn't eliminate the tax exemption for churches, mosques, and other sort of religious things. So it's really just, when I first heard it, I thought, how could you get it so wrong? And then a lot of the punditry that's coming out after this is that Parti Québécois really wants to lose on this because they see it as a way to gain votes that they lost because separatism is no longer considered a big issue. Have you been following this at all, Daniel?
It seems to me that it's definitely very politically oriented rather than actually trying to, I suppose, increase secularism and to try and get religion in general out of, I guess, the public sphere in Quebec. It definitely seems aimed more at non-traditional Quebec religions. And to that extent, like, I don't think it'll stand up in Canada with the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. And I do kind of see it as more of a ploy, as you were saying.
Yeah, it's to the credit of the Harper government, which I rarely ever give credit for.
I didn't think you'd ever say those words.
they put on record that they are going to challenge this if it does become law. And it's one of those weird things that we, I guess as a Western society are now confronted with particular religions that have a more, for lack of a better word, showiness to them. As in, traditionally, we don't think of it as Catholic to wear something like a hijab or burqa or something like that, right? Although, to be fair, actually, a hijab, if you look at some Eastern Orthodox people, especially like Greece, Russia, the covering up of one's hair is actually sort of a weird tradition, but I guess we feel extra threatened by it. Because another thing that's sort of not covered by this, which again depends on which religion you've picked on, is if you're Amish and you're not, you don't cut your beard, right? That is a religious symbolism for your particular faith, but doesn't get covered in this. And I mean, honestly,
Amish are in Quebec?
not banning prayer at municipal council meeting. You know, I mean, at that point you sit there and say, okay, this is nothing to do with anything, but let's be a little racist and let's just stick it to the immigrants. What was it? Jack Parizeau is quite famous of saying that the reason why that they lost the last referendum was because of the immigrant population. And if this ever passed, you'd see a lot of that population disappear.
Yeah, I can see it as actually being pretty terrible for Quebec's long-term health from an economic perspective. Like already, I think, I can't remember what province it is, but probably Ontario, they were actually like advertising specifically to Muslim nurses and other people in like public positions being like, hey, if that passes, come to Ontario. We can use skilled workers and we're not going to force you to take off your hijab.
So definite fail in Quebec. We're going to split for a quick break and we're going to come back and we're going to discuss that, is economics a science or not?
Is the best tool ever devised for understanding
the world. To subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com. Understanding empowers you.
And we're back. On today's show, we're going to discuss one of the major myths of economics. In our current world, where society has been sort of contorted into some form of CIA torture, all for the sake of protecting the economy, economists have, really since the end of World War II, been seen as supermen. It is common belief that economics has evolved over the last century from voodoo to hard science, in kind of the same way that alchemy has evolved into chemistry. So let's start off with the question, is economics a science? Now, before we start, we have a problem. What qualifies as science? There are many different views on this topic. The Oxford Dictionary defines science as the intellectual and practical activity encompassing the systematic study of the structure and behavior of the physical and natural world through observation and experiment. Of course, this is making two fundamental claims. The first is the idea of systematic study of the structure and behavior. In our context, we should think of theories, laws, and the like. Economics is resplendent in rules and laws. There are many axioms upon which economists use as their foundation for theories and to explain the structure of economies. The second fundamental claim made is that it is the systematic study of something real. So theology, the study of God, may be systematic, but its subject matter is fiction. So it's not science.
I think it's pretty clear that economics is studying something real.
The real world does exist. Markets seem to exist. So at least at first glance, it appears that economics is a science as defined by the Oxford Dictionary. However, most people would say that to be a true science, it requires more. Karl Popper, who was an Austro-British philosopher of science and professor at the London School of Economics, proposed in the 1960s the idea of falsifiability would be another requirement for a theory to be considered valid. That is, a theory is considered to be valid provided it is not proven false. The classic example is that all swans are white is true until the first black swan was found. However, the claim that there are aliens on distant suns is considered to be true even though there is absolutely no evidence to support such a claim. Popper did not care so much about true, but was much more focused on false. Another aspect to this thinking is it must be possible to prove something false. So to Popper and those who follow falsificationism, that's a real word, a statement like, "We all possess invisible, undetectable souls" is meaningless. If they are undetectable, by definition, their claim can never be falsified. Now, some claims of economics will fall into this sort of meaningless category. If there is a claim that markets always eventually achieve perfect equilibrium, the economist can always claim that equilibrium has not yet been achieved because, well, you just need some more time. And that, of course, can stretch on to infinity. So far, do you have any thoughts on this, Daniel?
Yeah, so sort of like following with what you're saying, I think there are definitely a lot of issues with economics fitting perfectly into things like falsifiability. I think you're right, like the idea of perfect equilibrium is a perfect example there. It's very hard to falsify perfect equilibrium because in some sense, it's basically impossible. Like, even the people putting forth perfect equilibrium can't really tell you what perfect equilibrium looks like in order to see if the economy is actually there. It's this sort of vague idea that it's what the economy naturally goes towards. So the only way we can measure it is because that's what we have when the economy is doing its own natural thing. It's basically a tautology. And so, like, things like that are definitely not scientific. I think the best example for, I don't know if I'd say like a large body of economic thought anymore, but I mean Austrian economists are out there. For anyone who's heard of Ron Paul in the U.S. or Peter Schiff is sort of another prominent Austrian economist that's always on the news talking about how the world's about to fall apart. It is a big school of economics that is basically, in their own admission, they basically just argue from entirely rational humans and then sort of expand out their laws of economics from that. They pretty much don't believe in empiricism. They don't believe in testing. They're testing things out. It's very clear that that segment of economics is not a science. But I think to go from that to saying economics as a whole can't be a science or even generally isn't is going a little far. I have a quote here from Paul Krugman in response to sort of an article that went around that like went widely around basically saying economics is not a science. For those who don't know Paul Krugman, he's a famous left-leaning economist who writes a column for the New York Times. And basically what he said is, well, I'm sorry to say that they've gotten it almost all wrong. Only almost. They're entirely right that economics isn't behaving like a science. And economists, macroeconomists anyway, definitely aren't behaving like scientists. But they misunderstand the nature of the failure, and for that matter, the nature of such successes as we're having. He goes on to basically say economic research, as he does it, as he sees other researchers and other grad students doing it, acts considerably more like a science than, I guess, the economics you often see in, like, newspapers by pundits, or even, like, the, I guess you could say, almost fake research that, like, ideological or partisan research institutes will sometimes pump out. He goes on to say, like, the nature of the data economists have to work with. Like, if you're studying the entire economy, getting good data for all the different parameters that might affect the outcome of the economy is very difficult. It's probably you're only able to get close to it in probably a small number of countries in the world that keep very large data sets on economic facts. But even there, you're not going to get all of it. And because of that, it can be difficult to falsify. It can be difficult to test. But there is a lot of good work being put towards that.
Does Krugman give any examples of where he thinks it's doing good science?
Yeah, so the example he gives is basically for central bank policy, specifically the problem of what a central bank should do when interest rates have dropped to pretty much zero. It's called the zero bound problem in economics. Basically, it's generally understood that if the central bank wants to spur the economy on, it drops interest rates. But obviously, it can't make them negative. So once it gets to zero, for a long, like decades, economists have debated, is it even possible for the central bank to do anything to spur the economy? This debate has gone through many different theories, many different models for how it could work. But ultimately, the central banks of the world had to very quickly and suddenly put the models to test once in 2008 when the economy fell off a cliff. Very quickly, most of the major economies around the world had their interest rates drop to pretty much zero. And then for years, even still, the interest rates are still pretty close to zero, but the economies aren't doing great. They've had to put these theories to test to keep the economy from sinking even further. And there is pretty good evidence that they've done a good job. The economists and pundits who weren't as rigorous in applying sort of proper modeling, proper empirical evidence, have basically been saying for these last 5 years, either that the economy is going to fall apart or there'll be runaway inflation. But those like Krugman, who have based it off of the models that have been developed, have generally been very accurate in their predictions over the last 5 years.
Well, a lot of this too, like we saw a preview of this with Japan in the 90s when their economy just went through the floor and they ended up with a 0% interest rate. And one of the ways that they got around it, and one of the things that a lot of people have been promoting, is the idea of debt, right? If you print more money and the state goes into debt, that will create the inflation that allows you to essentially go below that zero bound marker.
Yeah. Yeah, Japan's a good example actually for a lot that didn't work too, because it was at the zero bound for so long with sort of a pretty stagnating economy. It actually has only been pretty recently with President Abe, I think, who's been sort of trying some of these new things that have been suggested in economic literature for the last decade that has actually got Japan's interest rate to finally start rising, and the inflation is no longer in the sort of deflationary zone. It's starting to actually creep above, which is usually a good sign that something is working there.
Except in England.
Yeah, except in England. Well, Canada sent their central banker over to England to try and fix it.
So I'm glad you mentioned Paul Krugman. I can't help but feel that he's kind of the Carl Sagan of skeptical economics. Our listeners, as you say, may have heard of Krugman from as a popular contributor to the New York Times and many other publications, including HuffPo. He's also a recipient of the fake Nobel Peace Prize. Yeah, okay, I say fake because Albert Nobel created the prizes for physics, chemistry, medicine, literature, and peace. These were funded by his estate after he died. The committee and the selection criteria were established in his will, and there was no Nobel Prize in economics.
Yeah, Don always likes to remind me that economics has a fake Nobel Prize.
It was not until 1968, as part of the 300th anniversary, that the Bank of Sweden established the prize in economics, entitled the Nobel Memorial Prize in economics. So it's not really a Nobel. But again, I'm sorry for my digression, but it needed to be said. So going back, I take your point, Daniel, and I'm not sort of disputing the ethics of economists, nor the rigor they pour into their studies, but only in the same way I would sort of not question the work habits of historians. Some historians do meticulous and analytical research, but this is only emulating science because it lacks the predictive nature of science, as well as lacking sort of the proper foundations of science, and I'll get more on that later. Now, another hallmark of science is its predictive powers. You mentioned that the data that they're using is much more fuzzier or complex than you might find in, nuclear science. But I think it makes a valid point as to why it is not and perhaps cannot be considered a real science. I think the real issue is not in the practice of economists. The number of PhD and, quote, Nobel Prizes awarded for mathematical modeling is stunning. The problem arises, and I think in parallel with something like psychiatry, is that because economics is not actually relating supply and demand, but human psychology, that the foundation of many of the science of economics, but not all, exists in the ideal world with perfectly rational actors that just does not reflect reality and thus fails as a science. Now, people could argue that part of hard science relies on concepts such as the ideal gas, the frictionless plane, and that's true, but there's one, again, major difference. Calculations based on the ideal gas produce predictable, accurate results. Economics really seems to fail this, again, in most cases. Part of the problem is that economists, as a classic sort of science modality, sees the economy as an autonomous, independent entity, that the automani of the system are perfectly independent individuals. As Margaret Thatcher is infamous for saying, there is no such thing as society, there are individuals. Don't get me wrong, I think there are things that can be learned in this reductionist methodology. In fact, in the arena of microeconomics, for example, I think there's been valuable predictive gains. For example, the idea of just-in-time manufacturing is responsible, at least in part, for dramatic increases in the productions that we've seen over the past several decades. But as we increase our scope from a company to the economy, economists still see the isolate. It is like practicing medicine by only studying the stomach. If you're trying to predict indigestion, this may suffice, but we gain no insight into migraines. I think the false reality of something like the stock market is an area where actually economics has a potential for being truly scientific. Because essentially, I mean, the realities in the stock market are sort of self-contained and they very tenuously relate to any real world sort of outcomes. However, when this fictional world does collide with the real world, for example, think derivatives when confronted by real people defaulting on their loans and real traders panicking, well, its shortcomings are quite evident.
Yeah, I think you're right in a lot of things you just said. I think economics does have a lot of issues when it comes to having predictive power. I think there are some areas and some generally some of the sort of smaller problems. I think there can be a lot of agreement amongst economists on what will happen when you change one thing, and there's a lot of evidence for that. For instance, something like switching from the combined GST-PST in BC to the harmonized sales tax, which is a economically more efficient kind of tax. I think there was a lot of good data that would have had efficiency gains, and any negative effects to lower income individuals would have been offset by the money being the checks that the government gave out to sort of offset that to lower income people. I think there are a lot of things there that a lot of specific issues like that where economics does have a lot of predictive power.
Yeah, I think one of the quotes that I came across is and sort of putting the whole idea sort of in a more simple way. Economics tells us what might happen, perhaps even what should happen under ideal conditions, but it's real scientists that tells us what will happen, and therein sort of lies the rub. I think in the areas of sort of behavioral economics is attempting to sort of address the innate ambiguity and chaos of the real society, and may eventually, you know, this branch may become science, sort of, you know, someday in the distant future.
Yeah. One thing I just want to add to that, the other difficulty that economics has, which is, I think, somewhat peculiar to economics compared to other disciplines, is let's say you asked an economist to predict what would happen, say they were, I don't know, September 10th, 2008, which, if I remember correctly, is when Lehman Brothers collapsed. It was sort of the precipitative moment for the economy tumbling in the U.S. If you were to ask an economist what's going to happen over the next 5 years, the only reasonable answer they could give you is it really depends on what the Federal Reserve is about to do. So there's a lot of issue there in that if we knew exactly what the Federal Reserve was going to do, economics could give you a lot better of an idea, I suppose you could say. Sort of like it'd be like asking a climatologist what's going to happen to the climate 50 years in the future, but we're not going to tell you at all what humans are going to be doing over those next 50 years.
Yeah, no, actually, I think your example of the HST-PST, again, shows some of the innate problems that I've sort of discussed. One, in the unpredictability of humans, and two, sort of seeing the economy as a separate entity. I mean, I'm sure when they were sitting there and they were running the numbers to whether they should keep it separate or go to the HST, there was like arguments for and against, but I bet you none of them thought that there would be sort of a groundswelling movement to have a recall essentially vote on the HST to have it all rolled back. You know, those kind of things would never have come into the calculation of economists. And yet, ultimately, that was the most important factor about whether they should go into the HST or not.
True, very true.
You know, I think the penultimate failure of economics, its inability to find a foundation in law. And I don't mean a court of law. Lord knows a lot of economists and finance people end up in a court of law, but sort of laws of nature. Even the unpredictable sciences like climatology you kind of used, or tectonics, ultimately lies on a foundation of physics and chemistry. I mean, science uses math, but as sort of a descriptive language, not as a foundation. Because, I mean, pure math really is fiction. It may be logically consistent, it may provide philosophical insights, and it may even be beautiful. But until it connects to the real world of the sort of laws of nature, it's pure fiction. And I think in this way that economics lacks this foundation in reality, that it is literally made up of whole cloth. And again, some areas, perhaps behavioral economics, might make that bridge, but at the moment, I'm not sure.
I agree with you to a large extent there that, economists reason from a lot of fundamental axioms, but they definitely are not grounded in reality in the same way as a lot of the fundamental things that a physicist is going to argue from. It's definitely not on the same level as that. For instance, I mean, a lot of economics does rely on, especially microeconomics, but I mean, a lot of macroeconomics has these micro underlyings in theory, is that basically the idea of bounded rational actors. So the caricature of economics as being all about these like weird, totally rational people who know everything is not quite how most economics works now.
What?
But it's also not totally off. Nowadays is more of an idea of bounded rational actors, and the bounded part usually basically means that they have either limited information or they logically decide how much information they want to get. So basically, there's a cost and time to getting information. And a lot of behavioral economics is starting to really question the extent that is even true. Like there's a lot of great work by behavioral economists on pricing and how we are easily fooled by different pricing strategies. One of the common ones is if you have something that seems insanely expensive, and then you put something pretty equivalent that's just like a little bit cheaper than it, then it seems considerably cheaper than it actually is. There's a lot of theories that for those who follow tech news, that the new iPhone, the new cheaper version of the iPhone, is pretty much that. It's not cheap. It's still an incredibly expensive phone. But next to the even more expensive other version of the iPhone, it can definitely trick people into getting it. And stuff like that is definitely not built into all economic models. And that is an issue. It is something that for economics to get more predictive in the real world, behavioral economics is going to have to start being able to sort of come up with new axioms to start with that are more realistic to how humans actually act.
Yeah, I think in the same way that you have philosophy of mind needs to move beyond sort of the theoretical and go more to the real life data that's available there. I mean, economists use a lot of data, but so many times they extract it from the people and just see it as abstract, for lack of a better word.
Yeah. But I mean, one thing I would say is you can find good connections in and data that's abstract without being, like, without having a really accurate idea of what's going on sort of in between. So basically you can find in data that A has a causal relationship with C, or at least A has a correlation with C.
Well, yeah, we talked on the show just a little while ago in our episode about big data about how during hurricanes, Pop-Tarts are big sellers. you know, who knew? Who knew? Yeah,
exactly. So you can find out stuff like that without having to rely on having these sort of axiomatic starting points that are actually grounded in reality. And I think a lot of like good economic research is actually like that. I think the issue is sometimes more with the stuff that they try and ground in ideas of rational people.
I think we would agree there to a certain degree. Now, I think the ultimate failure of economics, and I think this is going to be very contentious, but I'll throw it out there, is science is its inability to or lack of progress. Laws of physics have progressed from Aristotle to Newton to Einstein, each built on the previous while simultaneously improving the accuracy of the predictions made from the former. Much of economic theory definitely has a genealogy. However, it is not so much evolutionary as genocidal. Smith did not improve mercantilism, but he eradicated. Marx did not call for the improvement of capitalism, but its extinction. Milton did not evolve communist thought, but repudiated. If there were laws upon which the economics was based, then economic thought should also be evolutionary in nature. Now, I'm not trying to be a purist about this. I mean, but something like Ricardo's iron law of wages has not really evolved. Now, this law, for those people who don't know, roughly states that there is a natural wage, that a wage cannot fall below subsistence wage levels because without subsistence, laborers will not be able to work. In its simplest terms, the natural wage is a subsistence wage. There have been apologists who have attempted to add exceptions and caveats, but history has shown really this law is illegal, for lack of a better word. To put it simply, if it's an iron law for wages, then it should also be an iron law for investors, that everyone in society should be, given all things being equal, living on a subsistence level. And the empirical evidence is obviously disproves this. So it can't be a law, but simply an excuse to abuse labor.
Yeah, I find it interesting that you went with Ricardo on this. I don't think, like, the idea that Ricardo's law of wages has not evolved, I find a little silly. Like, it's pretty much been thrown out for sort of a labor supply versus a labor demand, sort of more modern way of analyzing the labor market. That's not to say actually that I think Ricardo's law of wages is actually all bad, so that laborers would actually have more kids when the job market was good and they had a higher wage, and then when the job market got worse, they wouldn't stop having kids, but their kids would die. This is a pretty sick theory. But if you go back through human history, it actually is pretty well supported before his time. But he happened to live through a time where this changed. Society changed and technology changed to basically allow people to choose not to have children much easier. And so basically as demand for laborers went up and wages actually started to rise near the end of his life in England, then this sort of fell apart. People weren't having the number of children that his theory would have supplied. But then it was thrown out pretty much. People haven't really been using that since then because it stopped fitting with the data quite clearly. I do get your point, though, that when it comes to, say, things like the minimum wage, similar arguments are made that that people working at a low, almost like subsistence wage, is sort of a natural part of the economy. Stuff like that is still argued, but it is argued from a more modern theory. although not necessarily a very ethical or moral modern theory.
Well, what would you say then to the idea that, you know, I mean, I think I agree that there was a period where there was a sort of repudiation of Ricardo's law, but we have since, well, the 80s or so with globalization, this sort of race to the bottom, which is kind of a common thing, which is perhaps a re-envisioning of Ricardo's law, that wages get suppressed based upon the number of people, and that ultimately for a free, truly free market, that they will eventually settle on this sort of subsistence level. For example, the median wage in Canada has been dropping. That we are becoming closer to China. And China, of course, has been moving itself up towards us.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the subsistence wage, I think there's still sort of a good reason to think that that is sort of a bare minimum that you can pay someone and still have them work. But I kind of see what you're getting at. Like, there are definitely some people who argue that that's sort of what the natural long-term level should eventually get to, that as globalization allows us to basically do anything wherever the cheapest laborer is, that we're going to sort of evolve down to like a common low wage across the world. But I don't know. I just don't see, I'm not sure it's widely held view by economists. There is sort of a more modern idea, which is really that the minimum wage, or like the minimum wage that any person should get, is based off of their productive potential.
But what about the idea that economic laws don't tend to evolve in the same way that they seem to evolve in physics?
Yeah, so to get at this point, I'm going to have to actually say that I had to do a decent amount of research. I don't know if it's just the way I was taught economics at UBC, or if it's just sort of the thing with economics, but it's actually hard to sort of trace the genealogy of economic thought and sort of see actually if there have been sort of evolutionary improvements throughout the years. But I did find a good paper by Gregory Mankiw, which we will post on the show notes, which I think does a pretty good job of showing that for some things, there actually has been pretty good evolution. So specifically for this, the idea is macroeconomics basically started with Keynes and his sort of general theory, which started around the time of the Great Depression. Over the years, it has dramatically evolved. Basically, after his death, a lot of people worked to make his theory more rigorous. When he first said it, it was done primarily with words, not numbers, and it wasn't sort of entirely logically cohesive. But sort of a lot of people put actual mathematical models on that around probably the 50s. The main ones are the ISLM model, which is actually still pretty widely used and taught, although with major modifications for what like a central bank or a PhD economist is actually going to use. And then there's the idea of the Phillips curve, which is still widely taught, but has been horribly discredited by data. I mean, I should say at least when I was taught it, there was some mention that the data doesn't back it up at all, but it seems weird to me that it's so widely taught, and maybe supports your point a little bit that economics doesn't always seem very scientific. But basically after those, there was a lot of pushback on Keynesian to neoclassical economics, which I'm sure everyone knows and loves. But then sort of after that, there was sort of a combining of the good bits of neoclassical economics, the stuff that held up to data and wasn't sort of dogmatic, I guess you could say. And that was sort of combined with the good stuff of Keynesianism to make neo-Keynesianism, which is closer to what is used nowadays. And they're definitely, like, based off data, the new models do fit data a lot better, are a lot more predictive. For instance, Paul Krugman, there has been sort of like a survey of economists to predict things based off of, I don't know, either their intuition or mathematical models. And Krugman, who's sort of a neo-Keynesian, he has generally been one of the best for predictive power with this, handily beating out, I guess you could call, say, the more intuitive thinkers of the economy, these people who sort of aren't using rigorous modeling, but instead are, I don't know, pulling stuff out of their ass.
Somehow when you say rigorous modeling, it sounds dirty. So. He did some rigorous modeling.
yeah, very rigorous. I definitely think there has been improvements in economic theories, economic modeling, but definitely not to the same extent of, like, I don't know, Newton to Einstein. It's not something like that, but it's economics' own little version of that.
Now, in some ways, you might say that I'm not really being fair, that in the hard science, you can do repeatable experiments, and you can't really do that in economics. And there's another sort of nail in the coffin to the idea that economics is a hard science, that true science must be able to have reproducible results. As hard as many economists have tried to sort of normalize desperate historical examples of a particular economic principle, the complexity of the system foils their efforts. It may be true that if you could repeat the experiment of a law of economics, they may prove to be valid, but lacking that ability, economics is not only not a science, it cannot be one. Evolutionary psychologists sort of have the same sort of problem. The science of economics has a strong foundation in math, but its Achilles heel is humans. We are random, unpredictable atoms of society, and more specifically, markets and economies. It may in the future, via neurology, become a science. Neurology is providing psychologists with their sort of laws of foundation I mentioned previously in predicting human behavior, although again, it's still early days. The reproducibility is the fundamental to science. So economics fails. End of story, right?
I don't buy that humans are as random as you say. I don't think they're entirely unpredictable. I mean, psychology, which has its own issues of whether it can be considered as scientific as physics or even biology or something, has demonstrated that humans actually are pretty predictable over sort of a host of different things, especially if you're sort of looking more at the average of a population rather than individual humans. And I mean, as a general rule, economics, even microeconomics, is always pretty much looking at an average of a large number of humans. For instance, like if for some reason, say you're just studying supply and demand curves, and as the price of something goes up, people should be demanding less of it. Even if there's a few crazy people who want something considerably more because the price went up a bit, there's probably going to be a lot more who want it less now that the price has gone up. And sort of, so the idea is really more on average. And I think, I don't think there's as much issues when you're averaging over a population as there are sort of predicting an individual human's behavior.
Didn't you just say that iPhones are overpriced, but if they drop the price a little bit, people think, oh, it's so much, and really, it hasn't changed much? I mean,
yeah, so, I mean, it's a very, they're going after a pretty specific, well-understood quirk that behavioral economists have known for a long time. And yes, there are issues with bring that into sort of, I don't know, into the like a pretty supply and demand graph, but the sort of majority of money that is transferred in our society is in pretty commodity things like food, raw ingredients to make things, where stuff like that isn't as important.
So there's one other empirical fact that we have kind of ignored, but, well, economics is fiction. And I don't mean that in a disparaging, dismissive way. But the rules of commerce are created not as a result of something from the universe, but from the imaginations of people. Marx was not sort of wrong in believing that you could create a communist utopia. In fact, the great economic advancements of the Stalinist USSR were a result of people truly believing in the sort of communal idea. I mean, ultimately that failed, but if people are willing to buy in, I guess what I'm saying is the rules and regulations of the economy, people's attitudes towards it are artificial, that if we mind-warped people, we could sort of rewrite the axioms of economics. If people were completely selfless, and I mean everyone, there would be sort of no problem of the commons. If people were willing to work, giving everything they produced to the state or our alien overlords, and be content with whatever rations they were given, and again, think of 1984 or Brave New World, depending on if you're a pessimist or an optimist, and yes, Brave New World was utopia, the economic system would work even though its axioms would be sort of antithetical to our current ones. So, I mean, economics is fiction on just so many levels.
I will get right back to sort of your major point there, but I have to quickly push back on one thing. Stalinist USSR was not a great economic advance compared to, like, I guess you could say more free market countries at the time. I mean, not fully free market, but like Western Europe, the US, it was not a miracle. Millions needlessly died in famines, just so that they could pump up infrastructure to make a lot more tanks. It's not that is not what economic improvement is. It's not about having more factories. It's about providing goods that actually support people.
See, there you're using your biases again. Because the people in, I mean, I get what you're saying, and I'm not wanting to say that Stalinist Russia was a utopia by our standards, and no, it wasn't. But to the people living at the time, at least a significant number of them, for at least a period of time, it was. They were willing to make the sacrifices. They were willing to die to create more tractors and to do such, because they believed in the axioms of their particular belief system. And the fact that many of those axioms were complete bullpuck, what is it, Levinskyism, and the idea that you could train plants to grow in bad climates was absolutely pure nuts. And you're right, resulted in horrible, horrible outcomes. But they believed in it, and because of that, you had the entire power of the nation working towards these goals, which, again, were antithetical to many things, but to them, it was rational.
Yeah, I mean, I should say this is not much of an area of expertise for me, and I did not research it a lot before this podcast.
And again, but, I was using it more as a hypothetical then.
Yes, so I will say that I absolutely disagree with you on Stalinist USSR being great in any way, or that people were really fully united in towards the common good, and it wasn't actually just a certain dictators trying to force people towards a bad common good. I will absolutely disagree with you with that. But on your more theoretical point, I do agree with you that economics is fundamentally studying people with a certain mindset. And that's a mindset that could change. I think maybe some of it is somewhat innate to people based off of sort of evolutionary psychology and psychological research, but I don't doubt that it could massively change, and that would totally make either economics as we currently study it entirely useless, or just would require massive changes to it. I think you are absolutely right there, but I don't think there is a good example of it ever really happening. I don't think Stalinist USSR is. I don't think communist China is a good example of that.
Nazi Germany before the war.
Nazi Germany before the war. Maybe. They definitely had a large economic turnaround. And I think probably to some extent was because not so much that people stopped being capitalist in a sense, but I think they started to think that Germany as a whole had a better future. So if they acted somewhat capitalist within Germany, then it would lead to better outcomes than if Germany was still sort of a weakening country.
So I'm going to close out our discussion. We're running out of time. So any final thoughts on, so let's assume that it is a science, but we live in a historical time where social divisions have actually probably become at an all-time low. If you kind of exclude what I sort of start out with, people are becoming more and more homogeneous. But our economic divisions have reached an all-time high. So with this, you constantly get right-wing and left-wing pundits coming out and saying, look, at our economic science proves A, and the other ones, our economic science proves not A. And in such a partisan ideological environment, what good can, quote, the science of economics actually do?
I think this is exactly why the actual science part of economics really needs to be more emphasized. I think economics has major incentive issues that, as a society, we should try and do something about. I mean, it's not entirely, just an economics issue. I mean, all scientists have certain, incentives to try and have, novel, new research, and this has sometimes led to, scientists sort of not being the pure seekers of truth that they should be sort of in theory. But I think it's really bad for economics. A lot of research that is done by partisan institutes or ideological institutes. So in Canada, things like the Fraser Institute, which has a clear ideological bent and clearly funds research that tries to back that up. That's not to say necessarily that everything they do is useless.
Yes, it is.
But you should definitely approach it with a lot of skepticism. I mean, when was the last time they posted something that goes against their general ideological stance? I don't think I've ever seen that. And that's a major red flag. There's no way, their ideology is right on everything, and they're just purely finding the data to back that up. That's one way where economics has a major issue. And then the other, I would say, is because economists are so often looked at to come up with solutions for how to fix the economy, how to fix the world, Gregory Mankiw put it, God put macroeconomists on earth not to propose and test elegant theories, but to solve practical problems. Because of that, a lot of the prestige economists get is based on real world influence. So major economists in history like Keynes or Friedman, Krugman, as like a sort of newer example, or Ben Bernanke, are big time people in economics, to a large extent because they're very influential. And you're gonna get influential by offering solutions that fit with what politicians sort of want at the time. And that is a major issue for economics sort of being, purely about seeking the truth instead of about finding something sort of close to the truth that makes politicians happy or that can be sold to the public. And so I think that those are the major issues in economics. I don't think that there isn't good scientific research going on, or that even that it's like in a tiny minority. I just think a lot of the public face of economics, there's a lot of bias towards people who aren't doing the more scientific stuff.
I think it's actually almost meta in a way that there is sort of an economics to economic science, you know, because there are a lot of people who can make lots and lots of money if the Fraser Institute's policy on taxes is accepted, irregardless of what it might have on the economy in general. It has this one group, so you could sort of buy your economists, which is, I wonder if they figured out what the ultimate wage is for an economist. But
yeah, I mean, the pessimist in me thinks that there definitely is that going on to some extent. Slightly more optimist in me hopes that it's really more bad economists, not bot economists. But yeah, either way, there definitely is an issue with sort of partisan and ideological people and institutes funding a large amount of research.
Daniel, is there anything you want, you know, 1 minute rant of your own at the end?
1 minute rant. Yeah, I'm not really sure. I will say this. I probably almost lean towards what Don has been saying throughout this. I was actually being a little more pro-economics as a science to make this more interesting. I think there are definitely enormous issues that economics faces. And sort of when I was studying it, stuff like this always sort of cropped up in the back of my head, like, what is the evidence for this? But I definitely think there is also a lot valuable in economics, and I just wish we had a better way to separate it from politics, from ideology, to a greater extent.
Or I guess it's all babies in bathwater.
Sure.
Thank you, Daniel, for coming back and joining us. Hopefully we'll have you on again about some other stimulating conversation.
Thanks, everyone, for listening.
And this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com. And subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars.